Today is Monday, September 13th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, tensions as North Korea tests cruise missiles.
A South Korean military spokesman said that Seoul is working closely with Washington to conduct an in-depth analysis of the launch.
Plus, Iran nuclear talks may be back on track.
We were coming to a point where we need immediate rectification of the situation. And I think today's agreement gets us just that.
Also, Amnesty International calls for probing the Ethiopia-Tigray conflict. Our top story today is in North Korea. The U.S. is keeping a wary eye on North Korea after it conducted its first missile test in about 6 months. The long-range cruise missile that was launched could give North Korea another way to evade its neighbor's missile defenses, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
North Korea says it tested newly developed long-range cruise missiles Saturday and Sunday. South Korea, which usually tracks and reports North Korean launches shortly after they occur, didn't comment until Monday. That raises questions about whether the U.S. and South Korea detected the missile test. At a briefing, a South Korean military spokesman said that Seoul is working closely with Washington to conduct an in-depth analysis of the launch. Cruise missiles fly at relatively low altitudes and can be guided in flight. That allows them to fly under or around missile defense radars. Analysts say the missile appeared visually similar to the U.S. Tomahawk, a nuclear-capable cruise missile with a range of about 1,600 kilometers. North Korea hinted its missile is nuclear-capable, though it's not clear the North yet has a nuclear warhead small enough to fit on it. Regardless, the missile is another lethal component in North Korea's arsenal, which has significantly expanded since 2019, when it resumed major weapons tests. United Nations Security Council resolutions ban North Korea from activity involving ballistic missiles, which potentially fly further than cruise missiles. By testing cruise missiles, which the resolutions do not ban, analysts say North Korea appears to be testing how far it can go without provoking a major U.S. response.
10월 10일 당 창건일 전후로 무력시 가능성 대자.
Seoul-based analyst Yang Woo-jin says he expects North Korea to conduct additional demonstrations of military power in the coming weeks, but he says he doesn't expect any major provocations that would violate UN sanctions. North Korea is frustrated the U.S. did not relax sanctions during 2 years of talks in 2018 and 2019. With those talks stalled, North Korea seems set on expanding its weapons program. The North hasn't conducted an intercontinental ballistic missile or nuclear test since 2017. Many analysts suspect North Korea won't take any step that risks bringing further economic and diplomatic isolation. For the past year and a half, North Korea has imposed one of the world's strictest pandemic lockdowns, leaving its economy devastated. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
The United Nations Atomic Watchdog reached an agreement with Iran on Sunday to solve, quote, the most urgent issues, unquote, between them, the long overdue servicing of monitoring equipment to keep it running, the agreement that has led to renewed hopes for fresh talks on a wider deal between Iran and the West. International Atomic Energy Agency Chief Rafael Grossi obtained the agreement in a last-minute trip to Tehran. He called, quote, constructive, unquote, before a meeting of his agency's 35-nation Board of Governors this week. Ahead of the meeting, Western powers have been threatening to seek an IAEA resolution criticizing Iran for stonewalling the agency. The resolution risks an escalation with Tehran that could kill the prospects of resuming wider indirect talks between Iran and the United States on reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. With 3 months having passed more than 2 weeks ago, the agreement came as time was running out.
We are back from what I believe was a constructive trip, very short but very constructive trip, which I believe helps keeping the process in a good direction and will hopefully bring us closer to solve some of the important issues that we still have to solve. I would say that my first concern when traveling there was that we had major communication breakdown with Iran, which of course is something we cannot afford, having so many important issues that we need to solve. I think that was solved. You may have seen seen in my reports that I said that the situation was with regards to the verification and monitoring equipment in Iran, and because of their technical capacity and specifications, we were coming to a point where we need immediate rectification of the situation. And I think today's agreement gets us just that.
That's International Atomic Energy Agency Chief Rafael Grossi. The Taliban government in Afghanistan announced an official policy on women's education rights. The move follows recent street protests across parts of the country, where women gathered and held signs in defense of rights that were stripped away the last time the Taliban took power. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
The Taliban said Sunday that women can continue their higher education in gender-segregated classrooms and so long as they wear a hijab.
The first solution is that there must be places where boys can be separated from girls. Or the second solution, there should be specified times for boys and specified times for girls. The third solution is there must be a partition in class.
Haqqani says the Taliban-dubbed Islamic Emirate will not oppose education that follows Islamic law. Advocates for women have voiced skepticism.
But every day we're receiving reports of rollbacks on women's rights. Women are prohibited from leaving the house without a mahram. In some provinces, they're stopped from going to work. Women protection centers that provide essential services for women who flee violence have been attacked.
Davidian added that safe houses are at full capacity. Last week in Afghanistan, women joined anti-Taliban protests in Kabul. The Interior Ministry of the Taliban government recently issued an order to end all protests in the country unless demonstrators first receive permission, including for slogans and banners. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Years after the United States and NATO ousted them from power, the Taliban are back. But as VOA's Ayesha Tanzim reports, the country they are trying to rule now is filled with a youthful population that is significantly more educated and exposed to international culture.
As the Taliban wipe colorful murals with their human faces from Kabul's walls, many wonder how many of the gains of the last 20 years will be washed away with them. The insurgent group now in power is trying to rule a country that looks much different than the one it ruled 20 years ago. And while the Taliban have promised their new regime will be different from the oppressive rule of the 1990s, the international community is expressing profound disappointment with their cabinet selections.
Those who hoped for and urged for inclusivity will be disappointed. There are no women in the names listed. There are no non-Taliban members, no figures from the past government, nor leaders of minority groups.
Still, it's a mixed picture. The Taliban so far have respected the premises of foreign embassies and the United Nations. They have also given public pledges of a general amnesty for all their enemies. And they promise to uphold human rights, including women rights, as per their Islamic ideology. The international community also hopes to have some sway over the group, given the country's dependence on foreign aid. That help is urgently needed as the country faces a humanitarian crisis.
There is an immediate and pressing need to deliver, on a huge scale, essential humanitarian aid in areas such as health, food security, non-food items, and sanitation.
The Afghans of today are more educated and more connected to the world through mainstream and social media. Since 2004, they are also used to a constitution that gives equal rights to men and women. Many of them intend to use those rights, despite fears of a Taliban reprisal. Tamanna Pariani protested against the Taliban in the streets of Kabul earlier this week. She sent VOA this message on WhatsApp.
For now, I don't have any plan to flee Afghanistan. I am continuing my struggle until the international community accepts the Taliban's government. If the Taliban government is accepted by the international community, I would have no choice but to abandon Afghanistan and seek refuge in another country.
The Taliban are wiping away many of the changes of the last 20 years, but they also want to be recognized as a legitimate government, and that may require them to step back from extremist positions. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
The U.S. is asking Ethiopia and Tigray to begin immediate negotiations to end months of fighting that has devastated the region. Amid claims and counterclaims of atrocities and rights abuses by both sides, Amnesty International is demanding that international and regional governments take a more active part in investigating the claims and prosecuting anyone found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Last week, officials in Ethiopia alleged that Tigray forces killed more than 120 civilians in recent days in what would be one of the deadliest massacres of the country's 10-month war. Spokesman for the Tigray forces, Getachew Reda, speaking with the AP on Friday, called the allegations, quote, absolutely, absolutely false, unquote. He accused Amhara Regional Special Forces of forcing civilians to fight and, quote, of course, they will be caught in the crossfire, unquote. For more, I spoke with Adoteya Kwei, Amnesty's Deputy Director for Advocacy and Government Relations.
The suffering, the destabilization, the displacement of people, the hunger and famine that is being reported, of which we are not able to respond to, the abuses against women, gender-based violence acts, terrible, terrible nature, and also the inflammatory language coming from all of the participants, including the Ethiopian government, are all serious enough that they need urgent intervention and they need to be stopped. Amnesty is very much concerned with trying to stop the violence and trying to stop the human rights abuses and trying to restore the protection of human rights for all Ethiopians. And we will continue to work towards that and continue to push for that kind of resolution, irrespective of what develops inside the country. But right now, there's increasing concern that there's no one who is willing to back down, to sort of pull back from this increasing militaristic approach and solution to the crisis.
There have been accusations and counter-accusations between all the warring parties as it concerns human rights abuses and gender-based violence. What is your investigation showing you?
Our report, which was released in August, found that forces aligned with the Ethiopian government had subjected hundreds of women and girls to sexual violence, and that the incidents of rape and sexual slavery constitute war crimes and may actually constitute crimes against humanity because they are not random and they're not sort of isolated. We did a report that looked at incidents in the end of 2020 and the beginning of early 2021. And so we fully acknowledge that this may only be the tip of the iceberg. But what we did find was that Tigrayan women and girls were raped. They were gang raped. They were forced into sexual slavery. Sexual and acts of sexual mutilation and other forms of torture were used against them. And that it was so widespread and seemed to be very specifically targeted that it seems like this was meant to be a deliberate type of attack. In other words, it wasn't just soldiers sort of taking things into their own hands. Our report was based on interviews with close to 70 people in both through the phone system and other communication systems, as well as interviews across the border in Sudan. And we believe that this really constitutes enough that the international community has to do something urgently and respond.
The Ethiopian government denies these allegations, and a few days ago, a report came out accusing the Tigrayan forces of being responsible for exact allegations that have been leveled against Ethiopian forces.
We also, I think, are aware of, you know, all sorts of allegations of abuse from both the Ethiopian government side as well as the Tigrayan side. And all of those really need to be examined and investigated to see whether they're credible and if the facts stack up. We believe very firmly in our report of August and the data and the facts behind it. There's no question that there is more that needs to be uncovered and more that needs to be investigated. And of course, even if there weren't more, what we did report itself is enough to demand an investigation and for people to be held accountable. First, that there is effective investigation and accountability for anyone, no matter what side or unit they belong to, is held accountable, because this kind of abuse cannot be sanctioned, should not be allowed to happen.
That's Adote Akwe, Amnesty's Deputy Director for Advocacy and Government Relations. He spoke with me from Washington. While 9/11/2001 was a horrible day for all Americans, it marked the start of a new era for Muslims in the United States. Shortly after the Al-Qaeda terrorist attack, many Muslims, as well as other Arab Americans, became the targets of anger and racism. Hate crimes against Muslims rose more than 1,600% from 2000 to 2001, according to the FBI, marking some of the highest number of Islamophobic hate crimes ever in the U.S. Ahmed Fati, managing editor of American TV News in New York, talked with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi about how 9/11 impacted the U.S. and the world.
Manifestation of the Islamophobia took many shapes and forms. That's, in essence, what we had. Dealing with the fallout of this new wave of Islamophobia, we haven't recovered from it, because now it turned from being something as a reaction to 9/11 into, unfortunately, shaping the minds and hearts of many people in America and in Europe and other countries around the world.
As a journalist covering the UN and the US, how did 9/11 change America and the world?
9/11 changed America forever. We started a new era from an open country to a restricted country. Yeah, you know, I travel a lot, domestically and internationally. For a good 15, 16 years after 9/11, I don't recall any time I checked into a flight that I was not told the following sentence: "You have been randomly selected for an extra security screen." I did maybe hundreds of flights. Not a single flight of them I haven't heard that line: "You have been randomly selected for extra security screening." That was not America that I came to. That was not how I dealt among friends, acquaintances, work, life, government in general. This was probably the impact that affected me directly. Maybe in the past few years, it started to ease up. I don't get this sentence as much as I do. However, if I'm traveling outside of the United States, even going to Europe, you hear it, we need to get a security clearance for you. And I would be probably the only passengers that would be subjected to that are those who have clearly either stated in their travel documents that they've been born in Middle East, North Africa, or their name resembles an Islamic name.
How about its impact on the international affairs?
We have seen, unfortunately, some states have opted to give up its citizen protection and privacy into the global fight on terrorism, which I support, by the way. My objection is that the violation of privacy, freedom of expression, I don't think this has changed. I have been vocal before 9/11. I'm more vocal after 9/11. And I don't think that this is something is even negotiable. However, personal freedoms and security have definitely impacted us. The whole world realized that it is not enough to get cheap sources of energy in exchange for the national security interest. We have started to realize that the religious discourse in Islamic countries needs to be looked into. It needs reform. And that has been a theme being echoed and amplified through the media in the Islamic world, the reform of the religious discourse. But in reality, I think some of these regimes are complacent into empowering these extremist ideas and the jurisprudence of the far extreme sects, like the Wahhabi sect, for example, that Bin Laden was adhering to. And in reality, and based on my personal experience, this have nothing to do with the Islam. I was brought up in my parents' house. And my parents were both Muslims and their family also. So it's not an issue of Islam rather than an issue of a political interpretation of this wonderful religion.
That's Ahmed Fati, managing editor of American TV News in New York, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shinawi. This is the Voice of America. Israeli aircraft have struck targets in the Gaza Strip in response to a series of rocket launches out of the Hamas-ruled territory. It was the third consecutive night of fighting between the enemies. Tensions increased after last week's escape from an Israeli prison by six Palestinian inmates, as well as struggling efforts by Egypt to broker a long-term ceasefire following the May 11th day war. The Israeli military reported 3 separate rocket launches late on Sunday and early Monday, saying at least 2 of them were intercepted by its rocket defenses. Pope Francis is urging Hungary to open its arms to everyone in a veiled critique of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's anti-migrant policies. Francis made the comment Sunday as he opened a 4-day, 2-nation visit to Central Europe, his first big international outing since undergoing intestinal surgery in July. Francis met with Orbán for 40 minutes in what the Vatican said was a, quote, cordial atmosphere, unquote. Orbán said he urged Francis to not let, quote, Christian Hungary perish, unquote. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The human rights record of more than 40 countries will come under scrutiny by the 47-member United Nations Human Rights Council during its upcoming 4-week session. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The session promises to be extremely busy. Nearly 90 reports on a wide range of thematic issues will be presented. They include torture, enforced disappearances, the right to development, slavery, the rights of people of African descent, and racism. As in previous years, the Council's laser lens focus on the way governments treat their people is expected to garner a lot of attention. Reported abuses, some amounting to crimes against humanity, will be examined in countries such as Myanmar, Belarus, Syria, Eritrea, Burundi, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet will present an oral update on the situation in Afghanistan Monday as a follow-up to the Council's August 24th special session on that country. The European Union, Mexico, and Britain, along with human rights activists, have criticized the resolution that was adopted for failing to establish a robust independent mechanism to monitor violations by the Taliban. Council President, Fiji Ambassador Nazat Shamin Khan, says discussion on Afghanistan has not ended with the special session.
And really, it's a matter for states to decide whether they want to take the outcome of the special session further and achieve another result. But I do want to note that Security Council on the 30th of August adopted a resolution on safe passage. It addressed human rights concerns, particularly as it relates to women and children.
Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says he is dismayed at the Council's reluctance to take on powerful countries such as Russia and China. He says he fears the Kremlin will not be held to account for its unprecedented crackdown on opposition parties in advance of this month's parliamentary elections.
Ideally, we'd like to have a resolution. At minimum, there should be a joint statement. But again, this is a situation that just because the government is relatively powerful should not mean that it escapes scrutiny. And this is, again, a bit of a test of the Council's credibility.
Roth says the same dynamics are playing out regarding China's abusive treatment of more than 1 million Uyghurs in internment camps in Xinjiang province.
China's always escaped formal scrutiny by the Council. There's never been a resolution on China. It's time to end that, given the severity of the atrocities, the crimes against humanity being committed in Xinjiang.
China maintains the Uyghurs are being held in re-education camps and that the vocational training they are receiving is necessary to counter terrorism and alleviate poverty. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
2 French politicians have kicked off their presidential campaigns to become France's first female leader in next year's spring election. The far-right National Rally Party Marine Le Pen and Paris social mayor Anne Hidalgo both launched their platform Sunday. Hidalgo, 62, mayor of the French capital since 2014, is the favorite to win the Socialist Party nomination. Invoking her immigrant roots, Hidalgo said, quote, "I want all children in France to have the same opportunities I had," unquote. Le Pen, 53, started her campaign in the southern city of Perduce with a pledge to defend French, quote, liberty, unquote. They joined a growing list of challengers to centrist president Emmanuel Macron. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
on the next Straight Talk Africa. We'll take a look at terrorism hotspots on the continent and discuss what's at stake. We'll look at how young people are being recruited by terrorist organizations and what governments can do to stop it. Join me, Hady Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. This Wednesday at